Log Talk Radio.
Piontek, and welcome to the Global Voice. I'm a life and wellness coach, and I'm passionate about helping my clients turn their obstacles into opportunities. Each week, as the creator and the host of the Global Voice, I have the opportunity of reaching an even wider audience and focusing on something that I'm equally passionate about, and that is helping to bring awareness to individuals and organizations that are changing our planet and making a better place for all of us to live. My hope is that you will find each one of our shows inspiring. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Global Voice, and I'm very happy to be back with you this evening. I've been on a little hiatus. I am now bionic. I have a new hip and a new guest here, and tonight we're going to be focusing on a wonderful organization that I support and am really very excited to be speaking with Todd Samsel, who is the new state director in Missouri of the Nature Conservancy. And he assumed the position on January of 2011. So with no further ado, I want to introduce Todd and welcome.
Hello, this is Todd.
Oh, welcome, welcome. I am so happy that you're here with us this evening to talk about the Nature Conservancy, telling us about what you do, sharing the good news of what's happening globally, and just learning about what your mission is, and let's get started. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well. Great to be here.
I'm very happy you're here, too. For those who don't know what the Nature Conservancy is, would you give us some background?
Certainly. The Nature Conservancy is a worldwide organization that started in the early to mid-1900s, really with an ecological focus of looking at significant lands, rare species, rare natural communities, and seeking ways to protect what we call our natural diversity or biodiversity. And that started with a few scientists in the United States, was formally incorporated as an organization in 1951, so we're celebrating our 60th year this year, and has really grown to an organization of over 1 million members worldwide. Mm. We have chapters in every state in the U.S., and we have programs in over 30 countries around the world. And our mission is really to preserve the plants, the animals, and the natural communities that represent the diversity of life on Earth by focusing on protecting the lands and the waters that they and people need to survive. And we do this through partnering with a lot of governments, nonprofit organizations, businesses, indigenous cultures around the world, and many other partners, as well as individuals. And we approach our work collaboratively and in a non-confrontational manner, but a very science-based approach to how we work.
Mm. Well, I'm proud to say that I am one of those 1 million members, and
that's wonderful. Thank you.
Well, I think the work you do is wonderful. There's a quote that I like very much that resonates with me, and I just wondered what it says, how it spoke to you, if it does. And that is Henry David Thoreau once said that in wildness is the preservation of the world. What does that saying mean in respect to the Nature Conservancy?
Yeah, I think it means the potentially very different things to different people. I think there's one school of thought very appropriately so that says, you know, wildness and nature has intrinsic value in and of itself, and it should be protected. Mm-hmm. We certainly don't want to be known as the generation that's responsible for the loss of any part of nature. And I think, but what it really means to me is that people and the well-being of human society is just intrinsically linked to our natural world, and we all need clean water to drink. We all need clean air to breathe. All of our lives are dependent on products that come from nature, and so we can't separate ourselves from it, and it's just critical that we preserve what we can of the natural world, so that we're really preserving our own quality of life, and I just think that's what it means to me, mm-hmm. and to so many people that work for this organization and in the conservation realm.
It is a very big mission, and one which is an ongoing mission, and it seems like the challenges get a little bit more complex as we continue in time. But there's also been a tremendous amount of progress. One of the things I wanted to talk with you about was the land trust movement. If you could explain that. I didn't understand that for a while, and I think you can elucidate on that. So would you explain that to our audience?
Sure. Land trust movement is something that really got its start in the U.S. and has been growing for several decades. And it's really about people in their local communities, from very small scales to very large scales, whether it be, statewide or beyond, like the Nature Conservancy. It's identifying important areas, and those areas may be important because they're scenic, or they're important farmland, or they're important open space, or because they may protect water resources or rare species or natural communities. Whatever the case may be, there's a desire to protect those areas, and that can be done in a variety of ways. And one way might be that the land is purchased from whoever may own it, and set aside for the enjoyment and benefit of the public. And other ways may be through working with the private landowners who own those lands to protect them through voluntary agreements, things like conservation easements.
Mm-hmm.
Where a landowner agrees to protect certain values of their land. It may be forest, forest land or grassland or important waterway, or it may be things like public enjoyment of the land. There are conservation values on any piece of land that can be protected through voluntary agreements, such as conservation easements.
Would you say that conservation easements have grown in the past, say, 50 years?
They certainly have. One of the things about land trust work is that we're not making more land. Land prices only continue to go up as open space and land becomes scarcer and so more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not possible to achieve conservation at a watershed or a system like the entire Great Plains, for example, mm-hmm. by buying the land. It's just not feasible. It's too expensive and doesn't work. And so certainly as we're thinking at larger scales, like the Nature Conservancy does, conservation easements become a way that we can work over much larger swaths of land that are under under individual ownerships, and we can do it much, much more inexpensively. So the land doesn't have to be purchased. It can remain in private ownership and still be protected.
That's a very interesting concept. And how do you get people aware of this to enable them to participate?
Well, I mean, the Nature Conservancy has 3,000 staff that work for this organization. We partner with land trusts all over the country, and so there's a lot of conservationists who are working within their communities to reach out to landowners and educate landowners on options available. We do this in a variety of ways, but it's really about those personal relationships and educating landowners about the options, so that if given tough financial times, selling land for development or other things that may harm the natural resources on the property, they at least have the option of being able to protect the land through something like a conservation easement, which can be sold. It does have a value, and so it does represent potential revenue for landowners.
Mm-hmm. How does this work in terms of nationally? What proportion, say, is from the West Coast, the East Coast? Do you have any statistics on that? Where there's there conservation easements? Is there one area of the country that's more concentrated?
Really, there's land trust work happening all across the country in every state. One of the greatest partners of the Nature Conservancy in the U.S. is the Land Trust Alliance. And so, you know, LTA.org online has great information about the statistics of where land trusts are located in what states across the country, how many acres are protected through things like conservation easements by land trusts. And so that information is available. The Nature Conservancy and our website, nature.org, talks about the work that we've done, where we've worked. We've worked to protect more than 119 million acres of land worldwide and over 5,000 miles of rivers. We work in 100 marine conservation projects throughout our oceans. And where all of those types of projects are located in your particular state, or if you're in another country, can be found at nature.org.
That's really good to know. I appreciate that. And we'll keep repeating that so people know how they can get involved, how they can contribute. You have a wonderful blog on there and information about what's happening globally. And speaking of globally, tell us a little bit about your global presence. Can you sort of sum that up a bit?
Sure. We work in about 8 different regions around the world. So we're working in Africa, in Australia. We're working in the Asia and Pacific regions. We're working in the Caribbean, all throughout Latin America, both South America and Central America. Here in North America, as I said, in all 50 states, as well as Canada and in Europe. And we're focused on major habitat types around the globe, like freshwater, marine, important forest areas, grasslands, arid lands. And we're looking at things like how does climate change impact those various habitats, or how does it have the potential to impact as climate change continues to happen. We work with governments around the world on different models of protected lands. So we're working with partners and governments in Africa on protecting large swaths of wildlife habitat. We're working in the rainforests and in the oceans on coral reefs. And our work takes on certainly a variety of strategies around the world. We've pioneered really innovative efforts like things called water funds in Latin America, similar to what New York City did as it worked to protect the Catskills which provides the source for its drinking water. We work with downstream water users, for instance, the tourism industry in Cancun, and the folks who are using water that is draining out of tropical forests in Mexico, and working to raise funding necessary to protect those lands that then in turn protect the fresh water that, that those users downstream drink. And so the work just takes on a variety of different forms depending on where we're at, who our partners are, and how we're engaging.
Just skipping ahead for a minute, talking about water, I know you're very passionate about the subject, as you are a fresh water scientist by background. And first of all, what does that mean? What does a fresh scientist do?
That can mean a lot of things. We have some great freshwater biologists who focus on particular fish or aquatic mollusks like freshwater mussels or snails or microscopic freshwater organisms. My focus is more about how our work on or our existence on the land impacts our water quality and how that in turn impacts the freshwater communities that live in the water. And looking for ways to work on the land that will lessen those impacts. I think fresh water is already in certain regions of the world one of the most limiting resources we have, and I think that's going to continue to increase. We're seeing record droughts in parts of the U.S. that have persisted for the last several years, and I think that those types of things will only continue to increase. Can be exacerbated by external influences like climate change. And so fresh water becomes extremely important, and whether you're an outdoor-type person or a conservationist at heart or not, fresh water is important. And so I think it's one of the most critical things that we can be thinking about.
You know, you and I spoke briefly about how most people don't know how water gets, say, from the river to our faucets, or
sure.
if it's actually from the rivers. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you would take a moment or two or three to explain to those of us listening in the St. Louis area, where I am right now in the metro area, what's the course that our water supply has to travel to get to, say, St. Louis City?
Well, it depends where in the city you are. Certainly mm-hmm. parts of the city are getting their drinking water from sources in the Mississippi River itself, out of the Missouri River, or out of smaller streams and rivers like the Merrimack River. Others may be getting the water from their tap, which comes from groundwater wells. Regardless, that water has come as part of a watershed from somewhere upstream. And a watershed is simply an area of land. When rain falls, it drains to a certain common body of water. And so that starts out as small runs and rivulets and streams and ultimately come together to form larger streams and eventually form our large rivers. And so depending on where you are in that watershed, depends on how many upstream potentials for contamination, pollution there may be. And so we treat our drinking water so that we're not drinking the pesticides and the chemicals and the sediments mm-hmm. that can wash off the landscape. But
so depending on where you're living in the area would depend on how that water is treated, I would imagine, and that has to be analyzed on some kind of ongoing basis.
It does. Our municipal water sources, our friends at Missouri American Water and other water suppliers are certainly doing tests all the time, and providing the appropriate treatments to keep our drinking water safe. Mm. How we treat the land in those watersheds, though, can certainly have a huge impact on the treatments necessary and ultimately the costs to the users of the water. So if we protect forests, for example, forests in the Ozarks here in Missouri, they provide a natural filtration system for the water that we will ultimately drink. If we work with our farming community to ensure that farming is happening in a sustainable way and doesn't contribute sediment and other nutrient pollution to our waterways, that's less treatment that our drinking water has to go through. And so it's safer and costs less. And so there's a real benefit to us as downstream users of that water if we can promote conservation practices on those lands upstream.
Mm. Well, let's go from Missouri to talking for a moment a bit about the BP oil spill. And if you have any sense as to how the waters are doing that have been impacted by the spill. Is it safe, do you think, to be eating fish out of those waters and drinking that water?
Well, I have eaten fish out of that water.
I'm sure I have, too.
The Nature Conservancy has been very active in the Gulf of Mexico long before the BP oil spill. And really, the Gulf was had heavy impacts from various human uses, both along the shorelines within the Gulf itself and from inputs like the Mississippi River. And so it was already a focus for the Nature Conservancy in terms of a conservation priority. And we were very actively engaged in cleanup efforts and beach watch wetland restoration efforts. And more recently, we were working to reestablish oyster reefs within the Gulf, and that's work that had started prior to the oil spill. That wasn't as a result of the oil spill. So, certainly I think time will tell as far as what the overall impacts of the oil spill was to the Gulf and the marine life in the Gulf. I certainly believe that nature is resilient and has proven that time and time again. So, where we can help to kind of give it a nudge and continue the restoration work that we're doing in the Gulf and lots of our great partner organizations are doing in the Gulf. I think the outlook is good.
That's good to hear. And I know one of the hallmarks of the Conservancy is to work collaboratively with industries. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. We work with a variety of partners, businesses and industries being one of them. And we have a very stringent internal guidance on who we work with, more importantly, how we work with industries, but it's vitally important in order to achieve natural resource conservation at the scale that we aspire to do so, that we work collaboratively with the very players who have the potential to have serious impacts on those resources. Mm-hmm. And we have some really positive collaborations with industries that allows them to have access to our scientific information that can lead to them altering how they work in order to have less of an impact on the environment. We have partnerships with folks like Caterpillar on our Mississippi River and other freshwater work around the world as a partner who's a major user of those waterways. We work with barge companies, and a variety of partners, too long to list, but certainly think that it's important to engage with businesses and industries in a collaborative way to further that natural resource work, conservation work.
I know that you recently relocated from Pennsylvania, and that here in Missouri, where we are, the Nature Conservancy has a three-pronged emphasis. Could you tell us about that a bit? And not forget to mention the update on the bison.
Sure. Well, the way the Nature Conservancy approaches our work, whether it's here in Missouri or in other places, is really to use science to guide us to what are the most important areas within a given region to focus, and not everybody can work everywhere, and so we really use science as a way to prioritize. When we look at Missouri, our work is really centered around our important grasslands in northern Missouri, prairie habitat that is one of the most imperiled habitats around the world. And we have some very high biodiversity, high-quality grasslands here in Missouri, and we have places where we have restoration opportunities to bring more of that prairie back. You mentioned bison. One of the things that we're doing in northwest Missouri within a large landscape called the Grand River Grasslands, just north of Kansas City and straddling the Iowa-Missouri border, is working to identify places to restore native prairie, bring back native prairie grass species, protect things like the greater prairie chicken that has been reintroduced in Iowa and has made its way into Missouri, a bird that historically was abundant and by the mid-1900s had disappeared from Missouri. And in the 80s, a reintroduction effort in Iowa brought those birds back to the landscape, and they've on their own moved back into northern Missouri. One of the major pieces of a natural prairie ecosystem in the U.S. would have been bison. Bison are necessary to churn up the soil, invigorate plant growth, and keep our prairies healthy. And so we've done some of that with prescribed fire, but this year the Nature Conservancy will reintroduce bison to a large ranch that we own north of Kansas City on about 3,000 acres of restored prairie habitat. And so Missouri will have a native bison herd back in the state. And that's exciting.
That is very exciting. I wanted to
not forget to mention though our other two focal areas in Missouri, and that is our rich freshwater resources. Within the Ozarks, we have some of the highest biodiversity freshwater streams and rivers found anywhere in the country, and so we have a focus of work there. Not to mention the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, and how we're part of those larger riverways. In terms of our freshwater priorities. And then lastly, our forest lands in Missouri. In the Ozarks, we have forest land that is important in and of itself. It's also important because of its link to our freshwater quality.
You're doing a lot of things. And I was also reading recently that you, in Missouri, you became the recipient, not you personally, but the Nature Conservancy in Missouri has concluded the largest campaign for conservation in the state's history. And the campaign raised over $23 million. Is that correct?
That is correct. Over the last 6 years, the Missouri chapter had been in this campaign for conservation. And it really, to me, shows the dedication of the citizens of Missouri to conservation efforts, and it was a tremendous undertaking, and I think the work that we do and the fact that we can raise money to support those efforts really goes to the recognition of protecting Missouri's natural and cultural heritage. Things like prairies and our Ozark streams are really treasures not to be lost. And people understand the economic connection, and so our work is really about protecting working forest lands, sustainably managed forest lands, our working farmlands, and that freshwater economic connection and the societal need. So, you know, it's a tribute and a testimony to the conservation ethic that Missouri residents have.
An exciting time for you to be at the helm here.
Absolutely. It was an honor to come out here and begin working as the new state director.
Well, we're privileged to have you.
Thank you. You're
welcome. There's so many things I want to get to. I wanted to talk a little bit about partnerships, and we talked about some of them a bit earlier with industry. What about here in Missouri? What do you see that some of the opportunities are to expand partnerships in terms of, say, feeding the global community, which, you know, we're looking at the year 2050, which seems like a long ways away, but with the population predictions being what they are, it is a little bit ominous, and wondering what the Nature Conservancy is thinking about in that regard.
Sure. Well, yes, partnerships are really a keystone of our work, and we have great partnerships with a lot of entities in Missouri already. We work with our state government agencies, our Department of Conservation, our Department of Natural Resources, state parks. We work with our federal agencies, with the Forest Service and NRCS, and the list goes on and on. We work with really important private entities like the Ozarks Regional Land Trust and the Conservation Federation of Missouri and private foundations and a very long list. But, you know, really the issue that you talked about is, you know, I think there's some exciting opportunities to expand our relationships with folks like the Missouri Botanical Gardens, the zoo, in particular the Danforth Plant Science Center, which is working exactly on the issue that you just mentioned. And one of the things the Nature Conservancy is, you know, really thinking about is that as we approach the potential for 9 billion people on the planet by 2050, we have to be able to feed 9 billion people. And there's only so much land that is available or suitable for agriculture around the globe. And so it's going to mean that we have to increase the land's ability to produce food and ensure that as we expand into other potential lands for agriculture, that we're not destroying natural habitats and natural resources. And so as the Nature Conservancy focuses on the conservation of the natural resources, there's just a logical partnership opportunity for groups like the Danforth Plant Science Center, who's working on the agricultural side of things and how we can do agriculture sustainably to feed the potential for 9 billion people.
There do seem to be a lot of exciting possibilities with regard to that kind of a collaboration.
Absolutely.
And with Earth Day coming up on April 22nd, about 10 days from now. Now, I know the Conservancy is going to be involved in some activities and we'll be celebrating the planet we live on. Can you tell us about any of the things that the organization is focusing on?
Sure. We're promoting what we're calling Picnic for the Planet. And, you know, there's, again, nature.org has a lot of information. You can locate picnics that have already been set up. There's opportunities if you're interested in setting up a picnic in your area to do so and invite others to join. But the goal there is to promote people thinking about eating sustainably, eating mm-hmm. food that has been raised in sustainable ways, grown locally, and just really getting out and enjoying the outdoors.
I love that idea. I just think that's such a wonderful thing, bringing folks together to share a meal, which is nurturing. So it's that whole nature and nurture connection.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's great. We don't have a whole lot of time, and I really did want to leave time for our magic genie to grant you three wishes. And so if the genie were to grant you three wishes, what would they be?
Yeah, great question. Well, my wife and I have two boys, Jacob's 5 and Joshua's 10, and you know, they really do mean the world to me, and they're really the reason that I got into the work that I do. And you know, my first wish would be to really know that the work that I've devoted my life to with this organization has made a positive difference in their futures and in the futures of their children. I mean, we do not want to be the generation that our grandchildren look back on and fault for the condition of the earth. And so that would really be my first wish.
That's beautiful. I have a Jacob too, by the way. Only he's 20 years older than your Jacob.
Yeah. Well, the time goes fast, and
it really does. What a lovely wish that is.
It's certainly hard being apart from them. They're still in Pennsylvania, and we're working on the transition. So,
I know you'll be looking forward to that. Hopefully, you'll have a picnic on April the 22nd.
Yeah,
together.
Absolutely. Yes.
And wish number two.
Wish number two would just be that. You know, people, governments, industries, we would have the collective will to make the changes we need to make to really save this planet and save ourselves. We have the ability to do it. We know things like oil dependency is not good, and sustainable energy choices are out there, and that we can make a difference in how the Earth's climate is changing, and it's just having the will to do it. So I think that would be number two, and it would just go so far to the mission that we're trying to achieve. And
on that note, how do you feel that the political landscape is responding to those needs right now?
Well, you know, the political landscape is dealing with so many issues, and we, mm-hmm. you know, as a nature conservancy, understand that you know, environmental conservation is just one of a number of issues. You know, we of course, given our mission, think it's one of the most important. But you know, we work very closely with our federal and state governments, local governments, and governments around the world to help. Help promote, you know, programs and support and funding for things that the environment needs and ultimately people need. And so, given the economic climate that we're dealing with, anything is an uphill battle. But we're engaged in those uphill struggles and you know, we're working with our governments to make. You know, make the things happen that need to.
Well, that's good. Hopeful. That sounds very hopeful.
Yeah. So I guess I have one more.
You do have one more.
You know, I think working for this organization, I so admire the members that make our work possible, the trustees and volunteers that support us and help us do our work. The work is so broad and touches everyone's lives. You know, I would just love to have more knowledge for people about what the Nature Conservancy is all about, and that would certainly just go a long way, I think, in terms of support for the work that we do, support for our partners' work, and just get people more engaged. So, you know, again, it's having people know who the Nature Conservancy is and learn about how to be involved.
And so that's why everybody's going to go to nature.org after the show this evening to check it out. It really is a wonderful website. It's incredibly informative. As a member, I love getting your magazine because it's so the pictures are magnificent. It's like National Geographic. It's so informative.
It is a great magazine.
It really is. Just a pictorial of the kind of work that you're doing globally. It's very impactful, and it's inspiring. So I encourage everyone to get on board and become a member of this wonderful organization to help this planet bloom and grow and sustain all the things that are here now and treasure them. And I want to thank you so much, Todd, for being patient with us this evening. And we're going to have to do a little editing because it was a big gap. And I do so apologize. It's a first, but they're always first. And
appreciate
wish
the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I just encourage all your constituents to, if they weren't able to listen this evening, that they'll have an opportunity to listen to the archives. And just we want to get this word out about the wonderful work that you're doing and congratulate you on your appointment in Missouri. I'm sure Pennsylvania's loss is Missouri's gain.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome, and welcome you and your family, and hope they get relocated very soon because I know that that's really tough when you're separated from your family. So all the best to you, and I hope to be in touch in the near future. And again, wish you all the best in this new job, and then we'll be signing off. So thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much.
All right. Good night, Todd.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to The Global Voice this evening. This is Susan Piontek, and next week, April the 20th, same time, same place, please join me when I will be interviewing Amy Whipple, who is the director of the Midwest Division of ALS-TDI, which is the research arm of ALS. They're doing really wonderful, wonderful work. And Amy and I will be talking about the research currently in progress to help unlock the mystery of this devastating disease. And we'll also be talking with the director of a new documentary called Breath of Hope, which traces the challenges of three individuals stricken with ALS, all located in the same town. And for those of you who are in Missouri, on April the 27th, ALS-TDI will have a benefit at the Tivoli Theater. We'll be talking more about that next week. So thank you so much for your participation, and good evening.